Hello, and welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome back our buddy Bob Berman to the studio to answer all of your astronomy-related questions. Bob is a great astronomer and a prolific writer. He's written dozens of books or thousands of books. His latest is Zoom, How Everything Moves. It's out in paperback. The number to call here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can also email us, voxpop@wamc.org, or go to Twitter, tweet us at WAMCVoxPop, or Facebook, I suppose, facebook.com/WAMCRadio. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here, Ray. Well, wonderful.
I'll tell you what, it's very rare we start the show with all lines loaded. We'll keep everybody waiting for just a minute or two because I want to talk about Planet X, or the possible discovery of a planet way out there.
Yeah, it's exciting. Planet Nine, some are calling it.
Planet Nine, okay.
Yeah, it's been a while, especially with Pluto being demoted back in 2006 to a dwarf planet. Now it's been 1846 since we've had an actual new planet. This may pan out or it may not. I think it will, because six different small objects way in the far end of the solar system, Kuiper Belt objects, have odd orbits, and they can all be explained if there is a massive planet. We're talking about bigger than Earth, more like Uranus-sized, way out in the outer solar system with a period around the sun of maybe 10,000 years. And how far away it is, well, if Earth's distance from the sun is one unit, and Pluto is 30 astronomical units, this would be at least 200.
Wow.
And might be as much as 500.
So there would be very dim sunlight, if at all, out that far.
Oh, yeah. And its brightness would probably be magnitude 21 or 22. In other words, at least 100 times fainter than Pluto. So it's going to be tough to even see this. Plus, calculations show that it would be on the far end of its elliptical orbit, making it about as tough to see as ever. So we'll see if it gets discovered.
So this alleged planet is so far out there. Now, Voyager has gone beyond the heliopause, right?
Yes.
So it's gone beyond where this planet would be.
Nope, it's not gone to 200 or 500 AUs from the sun. It's a good question how far out it is, and I should have it in my head. I think it is something like 37. Somebody can maybe call it and tell me how far the two Voyagers are, but they're certainly nowhere near 200. And remember, this might be 500 astronomical units from the sun. So this is really way out there.
So this, but yet it is in the gravitational.
Yep.
If it exists, it's in the gravitational
pull of the sun.
Pull of the sun.
Yep.
And yet, if it's beyond the heliopause, the sun is just another star in the sky, right? You are standing on this planet.
That's right. We can even figure out how bright the sun would be because it goes with the square. So if it's 200, you'd have to multiply 200 times 200 is 40,000 times dimmer. The sun would be from there than it is from here, 40,000 times less bright.
Wow. So there'll be no chance.
But that would still be brighter than our moon. Our moon happens to be 450,000 times less bright than the sun. This would be only 40,000. So it would be 10 times brighter than the full moon appears from here. And all of that light would be concentrated into a single point rather than spread out the way the actual moon is. So it would cast shadows. It wouldn't be like another star. It would be still significant, but you wouldn't want to have to stand out and try to get real
get
warm.
For, all right, let's go to the phones and Mark in Pittsfield. Mark, you're first.
Oh, wonderful. Yes, hello, Bob. I have a question about Kepler. It's amazing. I'm reading his book by David Love, not his book, but David Love wrote about Kepler and all the things you just mentioned, and just looking forward to hearing your comments about Kepler. I called him once before with Jay Pasikoff, and my last name is Dallmeyer, so we had a little bit of optics background and telescopes and things like that. So really looking forward, and always good to hear from you or hear you on the radio.
Thank you.
I was just going to mention about Kepler. I've got 1,000 questions, but I'll mention a few and then just see how you want to come together with that.
Yeah, one is good to start, right?
All righty, good. All right, well, optics and then religion, it was huge. The 30-year war was going on, and he discovered a lot of this without a telescope. So many, many things that Einstein worked with, and you know, living in Graz, living in, you know, Protestant and religious factor, I guess, would be my question. And in the midst of all that, hardly having a telescope, identifying things that you're talking about, to me, it's just remarkable, and I'm looking forward to any comments you might have about Kepler, Johann Kepler.
Well, sure, he's one of my heroes, but since you're reading a book about him, which I've not read, and you're probably more versed about him at the moment than I am. Of course, I'm in awe of what he did without a telescope. The first law, Kepler's first law, essentially saying that planets go around the sun in orbits that are ellipses, was amazing because, you know, unlike a circle that has one point in the center that you draw, with an ellipse you need 2 points. And if you just put 2 thumbtacks into a piece of cardboard, let's say, and had a looped string hanging from those 2 thumbtacks, and then pulled a pencil tight, you draw an ellipse. So each of those thumbtacks is called a focus. And what he discovered in his mind is that all the planet orbits would work if they all went around the sun in ellipses, with the sun occupying one thumbtack, one focus.
So that was great.
Then his second law, which essentially says that the period of any planet, and this helped us figure out everything for centuries to come, that the period of a planet squared equals its distance from the sun cubed, that was, where did that come from? So in other words, if you take a planet like, let's pick Jupiter, it's 5.2 times farther from the sun than we are. So if you took 5.2 times 5.2 again, multiplied it, in other words, cubed it, you'd get, I think, 160. Well, that should be the same, Kepler figured out, as its period around the sun squared. Its period around the sun for Jupiter is 11.86 years, just under 12 years. Multiply that squared, and you get the same figure. I think it's closer to 140 now that I'm thinking of it. So the two, there's a relationship between the distance and the period. He nailed that. And then his third law, which is that if there was a string attaching every planet to the sun, the amount of area that that string would sweep out in space in a given period of time, let's say 1 week of the planet's motion, would be the same throughout its orbit. So even though it's going around the sun in an ellipse, so it's closer to the sun, it's sometimes farther from the sun at others, the amount of area of space that it sweeps out will be identical in the same amount of travel. Let's say in 1 week of travel for us, we're closest to the sun in January. So 1 week of our traveling in January, even though we're close to the sun, sweeps out the exact same area of space as 1 week in July. So his three laws were all done in his mind.
Amazing.
We're astonishing.
Yeah. Mark, thank you for the call. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Let's go to Richard in Queensbury. Richard.
Hi. Bob, a few months ago I heard you, one of your interviews there on Vox Pops, that you were mentioning something about like taffy strands coming out of black holes. And I originally thought that might be a concept that would be applicable. Oh, a few years ago on one of your shows, and you brought that up, and I was wondering, is that some idea that sounds like it might be some kind of viability there?
I know. You know, I was trying to think of what could I have said about taffy string. No, you know what it would have been? That if you were to fall in within the event horizon of a black hole and you were being pulled in, because the tidal forces would be so different dependent on distance, especially if it was a small black hole, by the way. Oddly enough, the more massive the black hole, the gentler it is to fall into it. Very weird. But if you're falling into, let's say, a star-type black hole, the black hole made of 12, weighing the same thing as 12 suns, your feet, if you went feet first, and you should always go feet first, your feet would be pulled so much more rapidly, more forcefully than your head would, that you'd be stretched out into a long string of like pizza cheese or taffy. Of course, human beings can't stretch quite so much. So in reality, we'd be pulled into chunks of like dog food.
Oh, fantastic.
Spaghettified, they call it, whatever.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Richard, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. 800-348-2551. Well, that's an interesting a bit of imagery that we'd be pulled into dog food. thanks for that this early in the program. And the the planets were aligned earlier about a month ago. And it was so impressive to see.
Did you see it?
Yeah.
You really got up to see it?
It was right at the back. Well, I get up very, very early.
I see. And now, my question to you, Ray, is could you see the hardest of them, Mercury, the one on the extreme left?
Sadly, no, because my neighbor often leaves her light on her back porch for no reason.
That was going to be the tough one, Mercury.
Yeah, so I did not see that. But the big ones were easily seen.
Right. And what the mass media did is they told people to go out during the first week when it was technically visible, but it would not have been visible because Mercury was so dim at that time and so low, and the twilight, of course, is already underway when you can see it, that it would have been impossible. So
yeah.
It was during week number two and week number three that Mercury got brighter and brighter. In other words, a week ago and 10 days ago is the best time to see that. That's great.
Oh, that's it. Yeah, I guess maybe it was during the fun drive that I was getting up and watching it. Yeah, and my kids wanted to get up too. But then every time I tried to wake them up, they'd go, forget it. All right, let's take a break. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop. Bob Berman's here. We talk astronomy.
Support for WAMC comes from Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York. Specializing in European car sales and service for over 20 years, QFCC.com. Capital Roots, celebrating 40 years of providing fresh food and green spaces for the Capital Region. Grow, educate, provide. CapitalRoots.org for details. Empire State Youth Orchestra, presenting Music and Chocolate as ESYO's Repertory Orchestra performs Symphonic Chocolates and more this Thursday, 7:30 p.m. at C.A. Bhutan High School, Voorheesville. ESYO.org. Shire City Sanctuary, hosting a dance party February 13th with music by Homebody and DJ BFG. ShireCitySanctuary.com. And Real Seafood Company, Wolf Road Colony. Locally owned seafood restaurant and raw bar, RealSeafoodCO.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551, the telephone number. Ray Graff here, right across the table, Bob Berman, astronomer extraordinaire. And Bob, I saw a great piece. It was actually at the weather website, the Weather Channel website. It was one of those links at the bottom about these people who chase, much like storm chasers, there are people who chase auroras.
Wow.
And I guess some of these storm chasers in the wintertime, they go north and they chase auroras. And so they took pictures of what they call a proton arc, although scientists say, well, it may not be protons we're looking at, but it was a heavy aurora at the time, and it was a purplish sort of a beam that went up across the sky. And I know that you have gone and looked at auroras, and you've taken people to see them. Have you ever seen anything like that?
No.
I sent you the link.
Yes, I saw it. It's fascinating. You know, I go every year. I'll be there in a month from now.
Oh, really?
We go to our special secret places in central Alaska. We've been doing that since the 80s, and knock on wood, we've always seen great auroras because that's just like the aurora capital.
All right, before we get to the proton arc, how do people find out about that trip?
Oh, they want to join a special interest tour, specialinteresttours.com.
Okay.
And that's great. We had a few listeners last year.
Oh, terrific.
Coming with
us. And you got lucky and you saw some.
Yeah, you know, every single time. They're always fascinating. Now, they're usually green. I mean, you know, honestly, the pictures that people see show reds. I don't know about purples. Now, a photograph is not going to be what the eye sees, except for a green aurora. And even there, there's a little asterisk. Last winter, the group, we had just this gorgeous bright green aurora. It was traffic light green. And one gentleman said to me, you know, I'm frankly a little disappointed because I thought there'd be color. And I said, you don't see color?
Oh.
He said, no,
it's just colorblind.
Pale gray. And so I took a vote, and half the group, now we're talking about over 40 people, half the group saw vivid green, half the group saw pale green. I mean, a quarter of the group saw pale green, and a quarter of the group was like
gray.
Him, just saw it as gray. So the human eye does vary in their ability to see it. Now, a red aurora, I've been told by one of the aurora experts in the world, that a truly bright red aurora is a once-in-a-lifetime event because the eye is very insensitive to that color at low light levels. In fact, you don't see it at all at very low light levels. So a red aurora from glowing oxygen usually has to be incredibly bright for us to see that color.
All right, so what do you make of the photograph and the article I sent you that looked something not like any aurora I've seen?
No, nor I. And purple would be very unusual. First of all, it would be very hard for the eye to see. I don't know what would cause it. And the people were speculating that it was maybe a proton aurora, but the experts were saying, what? I don't know. I don't think so.
So the theory then is, at the end of a massive solar burst, heavier particles, right, or more active. I guess protons are heavier, right, than
much
electrons.
Much heavier, 1,860 times
so they would
heavier.
Be trailing, they would be trailing behind the burst of the lighter particles?
Now, they both go at the same speed, a few hundred miles per second. Most auroras are electrons.
Yeah.
Now, protons and electrons come at us from the sun during a coronal mass ejection or flares. And then as they cross the magnetic field lines of Earth, that generates electricity. And anytime you have a charged particle going across electrical field lines, you get electricity. And
right.
It's this electricity, really, that strips the few oxygen atoms that are up there, sends the electrons to different energy levels, and as they cascade down, that's what gives
you
us
get the
aurora.
Ionization.
Now, a proton aurora should do, except that it curves in the opposite direction in the magnetic field, should do similar things. I don't know why you'd get a radically different color. We have both protons and electrons up there. The main thing is that the electrons of oxygen and in some cases nitrogen are moving to different orbits, and as they cascade down, that gives us the color.
Okay. Well, I thought it was fascinating. Apparently, according to the article, again, the scientists they call it a proton arc. Not necessarily that, but they acknowledge that it is a legitimate phenomenon, maybe a new one or newly discovered one. Apparently not the only time it has been seen. That is why...
That's right. I saw that in the article. It said maybe it's a new phenomenon that they're not familiar with. Kind of new auroral phenomenon.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah, very cool.
All right, back to the phones we go with Bob Berman, 800-348-2551. Dorcas in Olive Bridge, you're on.
Hi. Oh, you are there.
Yes.
thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I have a weird question for Bob.
Okay.
Remember back when we had the blood moon?
Yeah.
Okay. I was sitting out in my driveway watching it, and then I said, gee, what would it be like if I were sitting on the moon?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, that it was so-called blood moon was, of course, during a total lunar eclipse.
Which was great to see.
It was great. We had two of them last year. And what happens during eclipses, the full moon is in Earth's shadow and gets some of our sunset and sunlight light refracted into the shadow, and that makes the moon turn red. So what you'd see if you were on the moon at that time is, it would be very cool, you'd see the Earth in the sky blocking the sun. So you'd see the dark side of the Earth, the night hemisphere of the Earth, and surrounding it would be a ring of fire. It would be like a red ring, which is really all the planet's sunrises and sunsets combined into a single ring surrounding the inky black Earth. And that would be the only light around you on the lunar terrain. As you looked around, you would be this red light that surrounds the black Earth with the sun behind it and unseen at that time.
Great question.
Oh, that gives me duck bumps.
Well, thanks for thinking about that.
Thank you very much. I really wanted to know.
I like it. Thank you very much, and I hope you get there someday.
Oh, I would love to.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. Robin in Albany, you're next. Robin.
Hi there. Thank you.
Yep.
Wonderful material, by the way, about Planet X. I had not heard that was going on.
Oh.
If I could follow Dorcas's speculative vein a little further, I have a large number of what if you were standing here or there sorts of questions, but I'll limit myself to one or two.
Good.
Suppose I've heard that nebulas can function as sort of star nurseries, that stars grow there. Suppose you're standing on a planet orbiting a relatively young star within a nebula. You look up at the night sky. What do you see? The nebula?
Yes, absolutely. But it would be a little disappointing in that when we look at a bright nebula, now the Orion Nebula at almost 1,500 light years is the closest and brightest nebula to us. And there are baby stars, and maybe of them some of them have incipient planets. They're all very young stars, so the planets may not have had time to cool down. But let's say they have, and they have solid surfaces, and let's say you could really be looking around. Instead of the nebula being much brighter because you'd be so much closer to it than we are, unfortunately, the gas would be spread out because it's so diffuse to begin with. So I've read analyses showing that it probably still would not show a bright, beautiful color. It still would be gray to the eye because it would be glowing so dimly because its light would be spread out all around you. It might be spectacular because it would fill so much of the sky, but you wouldn't see the colors the way you do in the movies, the way they depict nebulae there. You know how one spaceship is ducking into a nebula to hide from whoever is attacking them, and it wouldn't be like that because it's almost a vacuum. Nebulae are so spread out, the gases.
So kind of a mostly no.
That's right.
All right, one more, Robin?
Yes, real quick. I have also heard that most stars are part of binary systems, which surprised me by itself. Suppose, and you have already detected my ulterior science fiction motives here.
Here we go.
suppose, again, that you are standing on a planet that is somehow involved in a binary system. What are the possibilities? Does it orbit both of them in a big wide orbit? Does it orbit one and ignore the other? Does it figure eight? Does it switch chaotically between them, or what?
That's not sci-fi. That's great science.
Yeah,
question.
No, that's great stuff.
comes first, and then more sci-fi.
Well, you're done now, buddy. We'll answer this one.
Your first question: what percentage? It's about 50-50. Sometimes a few decades ago, binaries were believed to be most stars were in binary systems, and it was thought that by a narrow margin, most stars are like the sun and are single stars. And the last I've seen is it's somewhere close to half and half. Okay, so let's say you were in one. They really vary. There are stars like the famous Algol, where the two companions are so close to each other, they go around each other in less than 3 days, that you'd be rapidly going around the center of mass of the two systems. But whatever planet you were on orbits only one of the stars.
Okay.
There's no question. You have allegiance to one of the stars. You're close to one of the stars. And the other star, how that's going to look, will really depend on the system. A famous binary that amateur astronomers love, named Albireo, are so far apart, 4,400 times the Earth-Sun distance, that the other star would be really
just
not much
star.
More than a very, very bright star. On the other hand, you get stars like Beta Lyrae, where the stars are so close they've been distorted into football shapes, and the other star would be very much a disk and a bright object in the sky, not as bright as the one you were orbiting around, but a disk. And in that case, maybe tidal forces would even interfere or prevent you from having a stable orbit around one of the stars.
Very interesting.
In a case like that, so you get the whole variety of distances between the two members of a binary system, and each would produce different results.
Robin, thanks a lot for the call. So these binary stars that are so close together that they are becoming distorted, football shape, at some point, does one lose mass to the other?
Yes. In that case, Beta Lyrae, the one I mentioned, there's a giant spiral of material of one going to the other at all times.
So at some point, there'll be just one star there.
I don't know whether they will be pulled into each other or whether it's just material that's accreting from one star to the other. I don't know if the center of mass of one they'll ever merge. It's very rare for stars to actually collide with others. It happens, but it's very rare.
All right, let's go to Tom in Middletown. Tom, you're on.
Oh, hey. How you doing, guys?
Good.
Bill, I missed you a while back. You were going to have one of those viewings on the walkway over to Hudson. Unfortunately, the weather wasn't very good. My question was in regards to stars. Basically, I've been reading a lot of different information on how the old model of a nuclear furnace with hydrogen and helium, constantly reacting and causing the heat. But that it was probably more over like a magnetic or a electrical type of situation going on there. What can you tell me about that?
Well, no, it is really hydrogen converting into helium in the fusion center. It's a little tiny mass. I love the fact that when you look at the sun, I mean, if you're looking at it through some thin clouds, so you can see the disk of the sun. Of course, you don't want to hurt your eyes.
No, you don't.
But in the center of the sun, there's a little tiny ball within the sun that's only 1/200th of the volume that you're seeing the sun. Now, there's a little tiny ball inside of it, and that's the nuclear fusion furnace. And that is fusion. Hydrogen is being converted into helium. There is the loss of mass. In fact, the sun is 4 million tons lighter every second. I never can get over that.
No.
If you could put the sun on a giant scale and weigh it, every second the sun actually weighs 4 million tons less than the second before, because it's converting its hydrogen to helium. So that really is what's happening. There's electrical and magnetic fields there too, but it is a conversion of hydrogen to helium. Later on in its life, there'll be other things happening. They're even slowly happening now, helium turning into carbon and then oxygen. So other elements are being created. But at this point in the sun's life, it's really mostly hydrogen to helium with the giving off of all that
energy. It's interesting because I also, they say stuff like when you can look through one of the sunspots or, a space in the sun there, you're looking at the sun inside of it, and it says it's like, it's a less temperature than the outside, and that just couldn't be with nuclear forces. But,
No, that's true. A sunspot is thousands of degrees less bright than the rest of the sun because it's so magnetically charged. It's about 5,000 times stronger magnetism than the rest of the sun. That squeezes the energy a little bit so it doesn't come from below. But remember, when you're looking at sunspots, you're looking right at the photosphere, at the surface of the sun. The fusion-generating part of it, of the sun, is
way down,
thoroughly hidden from view.
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go over to Cookie in Del Mar. Hi, Cookie.
Hi. I just have a quick question about your guest's opinion concerning the electric universe theory, in which it is proposed there is so much plasma out in the universe that harnessing electromagnetic energy would actually allow travel faster than the speed of light. I know that sounds completely heretical because of what we all worship Einstein so much, but the idea is that these forces are, in fact, out there shaping all these orbits, all these, potentially causing collisions that were proposed to happen some time ago. But the basic theory about it all is that the enormity of the electromagnetic, or especially the electric part of the electromagnetic universe, makes for a great deal stronger possibility that we'll actually be able to travel to some of these planets should we be able to harness that. Because the distances would not be in light years. There would be no light years if that's clear enough. Is that a theory that you've heard much about and have an opinion about?
Only a little, but the facts really don't jibe very much with it. First of all, let me explain plasma to the people listening. Plasma just means broken pieces of atoms, that most of the universe are pieces of atoms. In other words, separate protons or separate electrons. That's what we get with cosmic rays. 90% of them, they're hitting Earth all the time, and they're mostly protons, the core of that's in all atoms, one of the nucleons. So that's plasma. Now, what about the electrical and magnetic fields? Yes, the galaxy is pervaded by them, but they're very, very light. They're very weak fields. They're so weak that it takes us a lot of research to figure out whether they're enough to bring star stuff, that is cosmic rays, how they channel cosmic rays in our direction, how the sun's heliopause, Ray mentioned that earlier, blocks it from coming. So these are weak but pervasive fields. Now the speed of light, you mentioned that also, the speed of light. Even though quantum mechanical phenomena occur simultaneously, they ignore the speed of light. They show a connectedness between things that are instantaneous, and their light speed is not involved. Nonetheless, if you want to accelerate yourself in a spaceship or anything else and start by weighing anything at all, and you want to accelerate faster and faster, you simply cannot reach the speed of light, let alone go beyond it, no matter what you do. And there's good reasons for that. We don't have time to get into it. But you actually change to, even if you started off lighter than a feather, you'd end up weighing more than the universe before you reach the speed of light. And the amount of energy to accelerate you to a faster speed, let alone to actually reach light, would be more energy than has ever existed or could ever exist. So there's good reasons why that can never happen.
Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of pieces missing to that theory.
Yes.
To say the least.
Yes.
Well, thanks, Cookie.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Appreciate the call. Our number to call here is 800-348-2551.
1-800-348-2551. Mr. Zach, let's take a break, and then we'll come back with a home stretch. And Bob Berman, your calls at 800-348-2551. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Amherst Copy and Design Works, offering printing and copying, sign making and design services, from booklets to stationery and labels to lawn signs in downtown Amherst, Massachusetts, amherstcopy.com. Pave, tile, wood and stone, using French artisan techniques to manufacture pre-finished oak floors, decorative and terracotta tile, and importing aged French limestone, showroom by appointment and online, pavetile.com. Lori Stillwell, CPA PC, providing tax and accounting services for businesses and their owners in Saratoga Springs and beyond. StillwellCPA.com. And Noble Home, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, custom designed panelized house kits featuring eco-friendly passive and solar design elements. Noble-home.net.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here, Bob Berman across the table. We talk astronomy every month or so, and this is the day, 800-348-2551. Bob, the lines have been loaded the whole show. What have we done right this time? I don't know. Let's go back and talk to Edward in North Adams. Edward.
Hello there.
Hello.
I have read recently that sailors, particularly in the old sailing ships, were able, using their, I suppose, primitive instruments and or their naked eye, to be, for example, dropped in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, look up, and calculate where they were and be able to direct their ship where they wanted to go. Is that true to your knowledge? And if so, shouldn't we try to learn that kind of great art now?
Well, yes, it is a great art. Until recently, it was taught. It was taught in the U.S. Navy. We're talking about celestial navigation. The finding your latitude, how far you are from the equator or the poles, that part's easy because, for example, if you look at the North Star, its distance from straight overhead is your latitude. Or let's put it this way, its height over the horizon is always equal to your latitude. If the North Star is on the horizon, you're at the equator. If it's straight overhead, 90 degrees up, you're at latitude 90. So that's the easy part. Finding your longitude requires you knowing the time. And this is why countries, especially Britain, were so obsessed with creating better chronometers, because you need to know the right time. And then with that, you can calculate what your longitude is, not just your latitude. And by the late 1700s into the 1800s, this had really been perfected to the point that anyone with an octant and a good chronometer could figure out their position to a few dozen miles, and they were all doing it. These days, unfortunately, or fortunately, thanks to GPS, where for only a few dollars, we can all know where we are to a few feet.
Yeah.
It makes celestial navigation, unfortunately, look like cave paintings. I mean, who would bother doing that?
I mean, what they said, they were, you know, they knew like 100 stars or something.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And I know from naval office,
it would give you a greater personal knowledge of the celestial.
You know,
sky.
I'm totally with you on that. And speaking to naval officers who had to learn the bright stars and their locations and use that not too terribly long ago, I wonder if that's still the case, just in case your GPS
I think they still do
fails.
Have to do that.
I mean, I'm as lazy as the next person. I'm an airplane owner. I'm a pilot.
Yeah.
And I sure don't use even yesterday's technology. I just rely on GPS. I know the sky, but celestial navigation, it's romantic. I'm with you on that,
okay.
But I wonder if it'll ever come back.
Edward, thanks for the call. Okay, now, this is my bad, Bob. During the break, I was supposed to give you this. Jess brought this in. And this sort of ties in to what we were talking about with Edward just now and also about the elliptical orbits of the planets. And this is from Ed, and I'm throwing you this, and I apologize for doing it while we're on the air. Ed says, hi, great show. Would Bob have any comment on this? This is an article, and I was reading it a little bit while you were answering Edward's question. And the headline is from SciNews.com. Babylonian astronomers use geometry to calculate Jupiter's position. And this is based on tablets unearthed in the 19th century, which have been translated. These are from 350 BC to 5 BC. I'll show you this while we take some calls. Take a look, because it's fascinating. If it's true, they calculated Jupiter's orbit 1,400 years before we did it again. So I'll let you take a look at that. Let's go back to the phones. Richard in Kingston. Richard, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a fairly simple question, I think. I was hoping to witness a full solar eclipse in North America in the not-too-distant future. Is one coming up, and where would be the best place to view it?
There is. You're right. It's for the first time in 38 years we're going to have a total eclipse on August 21st of next year, 2017. We have been so looking forward to that.
But not here, right?
No, no, no. The path will go from the Pacific Northwest and run to being over Tennessee. But there are places you don't want to go. You don't want to go where it's likely to be cloudy. That means the Pacific Northwest. Yeah. You don't want to go to the southeastern states in the afternoon, because that's going to be hazy or cloudy. So there are places that you're more likely to see it. Again, you could look at specialinteresttours.com and see where we're going and join us. But
the Tetons, perhaps?
That's not bad. It's going to be total over just south of the Tetons in Jackson, Wyoming. That'll be one of the places total. That's going to be a good location. So there'll be places that'll be clearer than others. It'll be about 130-mile wide ribbon that's going to sweep across the country August 21st of next year. We're so excited about it.
So when is the next time we would be able to see one here? In Albany,
okay.
New York.
All right. Not Albany. You are going to get one on April 8th, 2024. We're going to have that one in Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, and in our listening area up at Burlington.
Wow. In April of 2024.
That's right. April 8th, 2024.
It'll be snowing in Buffalo on April 24th.
Huh. But now, if you really want to be a stay-at-homer and see it from Albany,
yeah.
I happen to know that you'll have one on May 1st on the year 2079.
Okay. All right. So
that's like you have to eat your health foods.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen. When's the next total eclipse of the heart?
Of the heart?
No, it's a song. It's a bad song. Let's go to Steve in Hyde Park. Steve, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I guess there's speculation that the detection of gravitational waves may be announced as soon as tomorrow. And I guess the question I had about that was, is it likely that that will help us prove the existence of black holes?
It's funny. I brought this up with Bob earlier. I had seen a tweet from the SETI Institute, and I didn't have a chance to follow up and actually read the article before I came on. So I don't know much about what you just asked, but it looks like maybe interesting.
It's very interesting, because ever since Einstein postulated it, it would be, it would be great if it were true. Now,
tell everybody what gravity waves theoretically are.
Okay, theoretically, there is pulsations in the very fabric of space-time caused by anything changing its position. For example, collapsing, or two binary stars that are extremely massive could produce gravity waves. Now, how would they affect everything? They would travel theoretically at the speed of light. And as they'd pass through Earth, objects would slightly pulsate. So there'd be tiny changes. And I'm talking about tiny changes in an object's size or in its distance from others. So the experiments are looking to make precise measurements from point A to point B and see if there's any changes in those measurements. And we're talking about distances that are only not just barely detectable. You know, we're talking about a few hundred times larger than an atom changes, and yet we can actually measure those. And if that's done, that would confirm it. How would it affect everyday life? It really wouldn't. But it would be amazing that aspect of gravity is real, and that it really is a matter of geometry, as Einstein was saying, that gravity is a geometrical thing, a space-time distortion.
Hmm. Steve, thanks a lot. So if gravity waves are in fact real, then down the road, would it be possible to modulate them and transmit information on them?
I don't see how, because you'd have to have objects of such mass changing their mass to produce them. I don't see how we would do that.
Well,
but that's just little me.
That's just little you. Spencer in Scotia. Spencer.
Hey, Ray. Hey, Bob. How you guys doing?
Good.
Hi.
This is actually quite an out-of-the-box question for you. I'm actually curious what Bob's perspective is on space. I have a phobia of space myself, but I love the idea of stars and I love the idea of exploration. And anytime space is brought up, I just get into unrelenting amounts of depression and confusion.
Well, I hope you're enjoying the show.
now that's not like acrophobia or agoraphobia. Agoraphobia, I think, is the thing where you're afraid of like open spaces. Is that part of it?
No,
mean celestial? You mean like actual space beyond Earth?
Actual space, yes.
Okay.
Like it's a fear of just the thought of being as minuscule as we are.
Ah. Oh, I get it. Okay.
Well, I guess I can understand what you're saying. I don't share that.
Well, I'm just trying to get a fresh perspective from somebody who enjoys space as much as you sound like you do.
Yes, and it's a complex question. At least I could give a complex, long-winded answer.
Good, I'll nod off here. Go ahead, Bob.
Because now that we found that space is different from the way we used to think, that it's not really empty, not only is it filled with fields of different kinds, it's filled with things that we can't see, energies of different wavelengths. It seems to be permeated by what's sometimes called zero-point energy or vacuum energy. Also, the distances between things and other things mutate. Einstein told us, according to our gravitational field or speed, distances change between objects and others. Quantum mechanics tells us that there is really no separation in some sense between things and other things. So even the question of emptiness and space and what it is and whether it's real, it seems not to really be real. It seems more to be one of the tools of animal perception. We seem to carry space, just like time, we carry it around with us like turtles with shells.
Huh.
We create the definition of boundaries between things. So it's actually more complex than it seems at first glance.
Did we emptiness. Talk you off the ledge, Spencer?
No.
No. You know, the best way to get through all this is just to embrace your insignificance.
Oh, no, I'm perfectly fine with that. But it did give me a better sense from what Bob's trying to say. It sounds like he's got a wonderment of the energies that we do not yet know of.
That's it, man. Spencer, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go over to Greg in Kingston. Greg, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just curious about your feelings about simulation theory. I don't know if it's just,
what is it?
Crock or something that you feel holds any kind of weight.
Can you tell me what it is?
Some experiments done.
I'm just in radio, so you got to tell me what simulation theory is.
Well, the idea is that we are somehow, the whole universe is simulated by future versions of humanity that is studying their ancestry.
Oh, I like
and,
it.
And they're saying that, I don't know if it's just a bunch of nonsense or not, but they're saying that there's some studies going on in labs. They're trying to replicate atoms, and if they can do that, then they can replicate the universe eventually, down the line. I just wanted to see if there was any way to
I think that's a great theory. I don't know how you'd prove it.
That's right. Now, I've heard of this, too, that everything is a simulation, kind of a hologram produced by some advanced civilization or ourselves in the future that's projected backwards in time. The thing is, the ideas that I get from readers of the different publications I'm involved with, and that they're far-out ideas. They're mind-stretching ideas. But I've got to a point in my life, maybe I'm just getting old.
Yeah, well, I'm sure
that,
you are.
That something needs to be falsifiable for me to even take the first bite out
right.
of it. In other words, you got to have some experimental or observational evidence or way of indicating whether it's true or not true. It can't just be like, hey, what if the black holes are really alien this? What if space is colliding this? What if the universe is only a dream? What if, because otherwise the what ifs are
But isn't
endless,
thinking, isn't the wonderment part of how eventually things advance? In other words, you have to come up with a crazy idea before you figure out how to falsify it or make it
good,
right? Yeah. String theory, isn't that sort of, didn't that sort of, it might still be in that realm.
Yep.
I love that
idea.
Yeah,
you know what? I appreciate you taking my call.
Oh, sure.
That's great. So everything's a simulation. I've thought that for a long time. My career has certainly been a simulation, let me tell you. All right, let me go over to Stefan in Saugerties. You're on.
Yes, hello. Thank you, Ray and Bob, two of our great national treasures. My question is, Thomas Berry, the late, great Thomas Berry, commented that the diminution or the pollution of the night sky diminishes our souls. Does night pollution, light pollution at night, contribute to global warming?
Oh, that's a question I haven't heard before. To global warming. Well, of course, I'm with you on this, that anybody who goes out of the big city and stares at the sky in September or October when they, on a moonless night when the Milky Way is so present and the bright lights are absent, artificial lights, and you're soothed and put into a state of awe that makes you understand what the universe can do to your soul. You mentioned the word soul. And you have no sense of that in modern life. Now that more than half of the earth lives in cities, that's completely gone. And so organizations like the International Dark Sky Organization that is trying to keep lights pointed downward, limit billboards, have lights. Yeah, of course you need lights, but not unnecessary lights, not light pollution, not energy-wasting lights where you don't need them. And, yeah, there's definitely a place for that. There's more astrotourism to places like the Atacama Desert. We do that ourselves, take people there, and then they see what it's like. You're up far from any town, and you're up at 5,000 feet, and you go, oh, that's it. This is the universe. I tell you, that's better than any view through any telescope, just being naked eye. What it has to do with global warming, you know, I don't think so, except I don't see how it would tie into global warming. It's just they're lights. I guess the only way they're tied in is that extra lights, they had to be created by the burning of energy, which these days is still mostly fossil fuel. So there is a link.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's quickly go to Susan in Rexford. Susan, you're on with Bob Berman.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm so glad I finally have the time and you're there on this day.
I am
75 and I grew up knowing there was Pluto and it was a planet. And I was able to accept the fact that for a while it wasn't a planet. And Ken and I bought a telescope. I guess we were in our 60s. And we saw the rings of Saturn, and we saw the count of the planets and the moons of Jupiter. I mean, it's just mind-blowing.
Oh, cool.
And it really did that for us. And then I got on an interactive science page online, they were explaining about this electronic sphere around the Earth that protects us.
Yeah,
the sun's.
Yes, the magnetosphere.
Thank you. God, I lost my vocabulary today.
That's okay.
The magnetosphere. And I've read about it now. I've looked at it. I've looked after it. Even that is so small. There is such a tiny, tiny protective wall that we have between us and absolute obliteration.
You got it. And that's why Spencer's a little terrified.
It's instantaneous. And that young man that was on just before this other person, they called and said that he's frightened by the thought that you really start addressing it. I got a nephew who's an astrophysicist out at Davis, California. He's just retired. And I've never really even had a chance to talk to Rodney about it, but I'm fascinated with the magnetosphere. What and how was it? What other planets have it? Do none of them?
Well, Mars doesn't. We know that.
That's right. Mars.
We're out of time, though, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah. Just quickly, Mars does not. Venus does not. Most of the other planets do, and it is protection. I will say, though, that our atmosphere protects us more from cosmic rays and other detritus that could hurt us than the magnetosphere does. But together, they're why we're here.
Bob Berman, what a show. What a fun time. Nice having you here. Support comes from Interactive Media Consulting, Saratoga Springs, New York, providing logo and print design, web development, and digital marketing throughout the Capital Region and beyond. Marketing creative and business ideas since 1996. iMediaConsult.com. Flurry Lumber, Route 10, East Hampton, providing advice and assistance for projects small and large, items such as Benjamin Moore paints, hardwood flooring, enters and windows, Trex decking, tools, lumber, hardware, flurrylumber.com, and Poughkeepsie Farm Project, connecting food, farm, and community. Organically grown CSA shares now available for the 2016 season, farmproject.org. Bob Berman, thanks again. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Thanks to Rose Schneider, who answered the calls, our producer, Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, can it be another enjoyable program, the Science Forum? Maybe.